Right. Well, welcome to Echo, Adam and Kim. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule in the summer. I know I've been trying to sandwich in some vacation time in all this work that we've got going on these days. But there are exciting times and a lot happening. I'm very excited to have Lynn Brabender on the call and webinar to talk a little bit about the role of the rollout of PARC and how that potentially will impact concurrent enrollment programs. I also participate on the higher education leadership team with Lynn and many, many other people from around the country, and there's a whole lot of things going on that I think are going to impact dual credit. And then we will be hearing from Virginia and Colorado on some legislation that is encouraging pathways. That's another conversation that's huge across the country, career pathway conversation, and I'm so excited to hear some of that. Then I'd like to end today, too, with Adam talking a little bit about what we've visited so far on the state policy workshop in Chicago, but to have a little bit of a conversation about that and what else we'd like to get out of it or how we'd like to focus it. And then we have a couple of folks have already volunteered to be on a steering committee, and we probably need to leave here with a plan for some contact with those individuals if they're on the call, and Adam has that list. But with that said, we can go ahead and turn it over to Callie, who is going to talk some of the national stuff around PARC and what's happening in a couple of states, and then I will share a little bit about what we're doing here in Illinois and my perspective. Coming from the higher ed leadership team. So, Adam, I'll turn it back to you to turn it over to Lynn.
Thanks. Lynn, are you able to take control of the presentation now?
I think so. Let's see. It's loading.
Like it.
All right, good. Hi, everyone. Again, my name is Lynn Brabender. I'm a program associate with PARC State Engagement Outreach, and specifically I work with our higher education partners. So I'm just going to start, give you a brief overview for those of you who are not as aware with, you know, where we started with developing the assessments, just a little briefer on the Common Core and then where we are with implementation, but then really focus on the opportunities that implementation in the K-12 system presents for higher education, particularly with dual and concurrent enrollment programs and with placement policies. Then we'll talk a little bit about some of the supportive policies in some of our states. Then I'll turn it over to Brian to kind of talk about what's going on in Illinois, and I'm actually really glad that Brenda's on the phone as well because there's a lot of work going on in all of our states to really prepare the campuses to use the information provided by these assessments to really support students earlier. So with that, I will just jump in to a little briefer on where we started. Again, as everyone I'm sure on this call is well aware, historically K-12 graduation requirements have not aligned with the expectations of state institutions of higher education. We all know that remediation rates continue to be high, even though enrollment rates have increased. And so for this reason, just as a briefer, governors and state commissioners of education committed to developing Common Core of state K-12 and English language arts and mathematics standards that would be aligned to the expectations of public colleges and universities in 2009. Higher education and K-12 content experts, faculty, and researchers developed Common Core state standards to address the disconnect between K-12 standards and post-secondary expectations. And as a result, we have a shared set of goals and expectations for what students should understand and be able to do in grades K-12 in order to be prepared for entry-level college credit-bearing courses, now adopted by 44 states and D.C. So then from there, what is PARC? PARC, also in 2009, groups of 15 or more states were invited to apply for those Race to the Top grants to develop online assessments that would be aligned to the Common Core state standards and really provide clear indicators of whether or not students were on track to be college and career ready throughout their K-12 experience. So PARC is one of those consortia measuring grades 3 through 8 in high school, really developing a common tool for college readiness. And what this really means for post-secondary systems is that post-secondary systems and institution leaders signed MOUs indicating their intent to use PARC college and career readiness scores to exempt students from placement testing and from remediation on their college campuses. So again, we'll be rolling out the assessments next year in winter and spring of 2014-15 school year. So again, a little bit about the goals. The PARC assessment system includes formative tools and summative assessments, again, administered in grades 3 through 8 in high school, designed to measure problem-solving, critical thinking skills, give timely feedback to teachers and students on strengths and weaknesses, and allow teachers opportunities to better meet students' needs, really determine whether students are on track for college and career early. It will include a writing component at every grade and really allow comparison across schools, districts, and states. But really what we want to focus on here is that high school level in this slide where there's an opportunity to really see during the whole high school continuum from 9th to 11th grade, but particularly in 11th grade, indicate whether students are going to be graduating ready for those college credit-bearing courses and in time to provide interventions or provide early access programs to students who would demonstrate that they are ready early. Again, this just kind of speaks to how we see what the opportunities are with PARC implementation in the K-12 system. One, it's a common measure of college readiness. And again, hopefully, what we're hoping is that our PARC states can incorporate the information provided by the score reports into some of those dual enrollment, concurrent enrollment partnership programs and use that information to identify students, again, early who might need benefit from interventions or who might be eligible for early access programs. And the other opportunity is for decreasing the use of AccuPlacer and Compass and other placement tests on college campuses. So if students receive the college and career ready determination, they would not have to take that exam and can be placed directly into credit-bearing courses. But additionally, the score reports are being developed such that hopefully this information will also be able to be used by post-secondary institutions to provide targeted remediation and student supports, again, without having to readminister AccuPlacer or Compass. And I do like to reiterate that we know that we'll continue to need to use another type of placement test because this will be administered in the K-12 system. So for returning students and adult learners, there will still be a role for that, but hopefully we can decrease that. So we'll speak a little bit about the design of the system. Again, the PARC assessment system includes formative tools and summative assessments for administrations 3 through 8 in high school. The summative assessments are made up of two parts, the performance-based assessment, or the PBA, and the end-of-year component. The performance-based assessment will be administered after 75% of the school year, captures critical thinking and problem-solving skills via extended tasks, application of context, concepts, and skills. Those end-of-year assessments are administered about 90% of the school year. These are short-answer items and other performance tasks, non-performance tasks. There's also a speaking and listening component that will have flexible timing of administration. So a little bit about what we'll be reporting on the performance levels. PARC will report results of the assessments using 5 performance levels. In 3 through 10, and in grades 3 through 10, a 4 above will indicate the student is on track to be successful in the subsequent grade in each content area. Again, the PARC assessment system will be aligned to college and career-ready Common Core standards, and is designed to provide those targeted, in high school, PARC results will send an early signal about whether students are on track for entry-level non-remedial courses, and students who receive a 4 or above will earn a college and career-ready determination that's intended to exempt the student from placement testing and remediation at public post-secondary institutions. And again, that will be the Algebra 2 and ELA 3 exams that will be used for that college and career-ready determination. So we're working to develop score reports with K-12 and higher education representatives currently. The design of the score reports will be the English, language, arts, and literacy. Students will receive a 1 through 5 performance level and a scale score. They will also receive scale scores in reading and writing and subscores for reading literacy text, reading informational text, vocabulary, written expression, and knowledge of conventions. In math, again, students will receive that 1 through 5 performance level and a scale score, but they will also receive scale scores in major content, additional supporting content, expressing mathematical reasoning, and modeling applications. So this slide shows where we are and where we started. Again, we have just completed the administration of the field test, and as we move towards the next year, we'll be participating in operational administration in the spring and in the late winter of 2014-15. Again, that summer we'll be establishing those CUT scores, and that will include the participation of higher education to establish the CUT score for college readiness and for all high school grades. We'll be releasing the diagnostic informative assessment tools in the following fall, and then students will enter college campuses in the fall of 2016 who have PARC scores. So what are we doing to measure whether this is an accurate measure of college readiness? So as I indicated before, a level 4 on the high school assessment is supposed to indicate readiness for entry directly into those non-remedial courses. So we're using the following standard to validate that assessment, and that's the student who earns a 4 on the PARC assessments has a 0.75 probability of earning college credit by attaining at least a grade of C or its equivalent in entry-level college credit-bearing courses. To validate this statement, we'll be using research from a post-secondary educator judgment study, where we will be recruiting 300 educators from across PARC states to look at those items, those 11th grade ELA and the Algebra 2 items, and look at, really indicate how a student who would be ready for their college credit-bearing course would perform on that item. We'll also be doing a longitudinal study looking at students who take the assessment next year and seeing how those students perform in their first-year college credit-bearing courses. And again, what we've done over the part of the development process that really speaks to how this will be measured as an accurate, indicates an accurate measure of college readiness, each item is reviewed by K-12 and higher education content experts, faculty at each different level of review. So we have core leadership review, that's content experts from K-12 and post-secondary, and all items have to pass that review and to go on to the next review, which is state educator review. And those are higher ed faculty and classroom educators from across the PARC states. After that, the items are reviewed for bias and sensitivity, and then they are go on to the field test. And again, we just completed the field test in June. 14 states and D.C. participated, over 1 million students in nearly 16,000 schools. And again, 75% was the computer-based testing, 25% was the paper-based testing. So it was really great, and we've received a lot of feedback. It's a really great opportunity to test the technology particularly and make sure that schools are ready to administer the test next year. Future milestones for higher education particularly will be participating again in that standard setting process. We're currently recruiting post-secondary educators for the judgment study. And additionally, all of our PARC states are really looking, working with their campuses to identify where PARC would fit into support concurrent enrollment programs and where PARC would fit into their current placement policies, what's already there and who do they need to engage to make sure that PARC benefits. So I want to speak particularly to the opportunities that we see for P20 systems. PARC will, again, provide information earlier on. So this will provide an opportunity to identify students who need supports without having to administer. I know many programs administer AccuPlacer and Compass in the K-12 system. This test will already be there, providing more information about students. So we think that this is really an opportunity to incorporate that into it as an early identifier that can be used to, again, identify students who would benefit from a transition program or a bridge program in their senior year, or students who would really benefit from being promoted into those early college access and dual enrollment early college high school programs. As far as, again, at the post-secondary level, we really see this as a tool for decreasing the use of placement testing. Students will know that they are exempt from remediation, and again, early access opportunities, ways to use that more information about students, basically, earlier on. So what we're, it's particular to dual and concurrent enrollment programs, we've asked our PARC states to really consider what current practices they're using to identify students who are eligible for these programs. And who's engaged in those programs. So if we can identify that, then figuring out who needs to be involved at the campus level, what faculty, what administrators to really feel confident about these PARC scores and how they can be used to identify students, and then where that, what they need to plan on to move that work forward. A few state policies I was asked to speak to. Maryland has implemented Senate Bill 740, which is the College and Career Readiness Completion Act of 2012. Basically, beginning with the 2014-15 school year, and no later than grade 11, all students must be assessed for college readiness using acceptable college placement cut scores. And beginning in 2015-16 school year, the Maryland State Department of Education must, in collaboration with local school systems and public community colleges, develop and implement transition courses or other instructional opportunities to be delivered in grade 12 to students who do not meet that college readiness score by the end of 11th grade. Ohio has also done a lot of work in preparing, kind of building the foundation for using PARC. Ohio's public colleges and universities issued uniform statewide standards for students to be considered remediation-free for college-level English, writing, math, and science. The new remediation policy creates a placeholder for PARC college and career-ready determination to be used as one of multiple measures to exempt students from remediation. Ohio is also working to develop pilot 12th grade transition courses that can be provided to students who do not meet that remediation-free standard. I also know that Colorado has a placeholder for PARC as one of multiple measures for exempting students from remediation on their college campuses. At this point, I just wanted to turn to Brian, who presented recently at our Educator Leader Cadre meeting, and kind of discuss how Illinois is preparing to use PARC in their concurrent enrollment programs and their placement policies.
Thanks, Lynn, and I'll just talk for a moment, and then I want to, if we have the time here, to open it up. Anybody has any questions? In Illinois, we have been very engaged with, from a higher education point of view, in the implementation and communication strategies around PARC, both in partnership with PARC Inc. and Lynn and her team, as well as here with all of our institutions. We've had multiple events where we have done some training and some deeper dives into PARC, including allowing folks to take a look at some of the specific test items that are out there, some of the practice items, and working with content experts to look at those. So we've done, I think, a pretty good job of sharing that information in the higher education realm. Certainly some of the things that Lynn hit on are all the same sorts of questions and areas that we're still trying to figure out. One of them, and I think to Lynn's point about how PARC can support concurrent enrollment, is that notion of score reporting and when we get those scores to us in higher education in Illinois is really going to be the number one question. And if we can fulfill the promise of getting the scores quickly and utilizing it to help place students, then I think we've got the potential to significantly expand dual credit opportunities. If we don't, then we're going to have a bit of a dual system running for a little bit as we make that transition. But ultimately, I see some real opportunity for dual credit and dual concurrent enrollment possible, as well as what Lynn said around targeted interventions. We do not have any specific legislation here that is addressing PARC and dual credit. However, we certainly have some that is targeted around the PARC assessment and the implementation of large-scale assessments. But we do have some rules that allow us to figure out a way to implement PARC that in the dual credit or concurrent enrollment programs that should work pretty well, provided score reports come when we need them. And basically, the policies on campus are that students are required to be administered or be given the same opportunities as native students. So if a student is a sophomore, goes into that junior year, takes their PARC exam, and wants to go into concurrent enrollment in the 12th grade, if on campus they're accepting PARC, then institutions are required to accept that same assessment for those students in the 11th grade going to 12th grade. So as PARC is implemented on campus, it will naturally flow into concurrent enrollment programs, so we don't see that there's going to be a major hitch there. However, an exciting prospect for me is that it's certainly going to force the examination of placement policies as it relates to concurrent enrollment and just overall on campus, because all institutions are being asked to think about PARC, look at how they're going to implement it. So naturally, that those two conversations go together. And so we may find ourselves in a place, and particularly as it relates to career and technical education, where some of the scores that have creeped up and been required for some of these courses could be weeded out, because I'm not sure that they're necessary. And so that in and of itself, I mean, just some thoughtful conversation around placement, I think, is going to be a very positive thing that's going to happen with the implementation of PARC. That's going to impact campuses and concurrent enrollment at the same time. One of the things that we're doing now that is very critical to this conversation is we've convened a task force of chief academic officers in the community college system who are developing a policy response to some of the unknowns around PARC that colleges are going to have to deal with. And concurrent enrollment is likely to make its way onto that list. But some of those things include the fourth-year math. You know, what if a student doesn't take a fourth-year math? In Illinois, they're not required to take a fourth-year math. Or what if a student sits out for a year and comes back to the college? I mean, some of these sorts of fine-grained or more nuanced issues around placement are being considered. And I expect that task force will make its way into the dual-credit space. But given the rules that we have in place, I generally see nothing but positive opportunities for concurrent enrollment or dual credit in Illinois. So with that said, Adam, I'd like to, if we have a moment, give anyone on the webinar an opportunity to ask Lynn any questions, or you can ask me any questions you might have as well, if that makes sense.
We definitely have time, so let's go ahead and do that. I'm going to go ahead and unmute the line. Who would like to go first with a question? Well, I've got one. So, Lynn, Brian was talking about the dialogue that's happening among the chief academic officers in Illinois with regards to utilizing PARC as a placement test. What's the progress in the PARC states from the higher ed perspective in terms of looking at this as a potential down the road future placement test, and kind of what would you expect the timeline will be in most states?
I think that is a very nuanced question, because every state is kind of approaching it a little bit differently. What I can say is that we have a lot of engagement, particularly around the standard setting process. That's going to be a really big piece for higher ed. I think that across our PARC states, many states have developed infrastructures where they have a campus lead at every single post-secondary campus, and then have a campus team working on, you know, making sure that all the right people are aware of these assessments and their implementation in the K-12 system, specifically Massachusetts and Louisiana and New Jersey, and beginning to be also New Mexico. But I think that that's really the goal, is to really build out that communication infrastructure first. But before any of our institutions, you know, they all decided that they would use this as a placement tool based on the validation with the research, right? So a big piece right now going forward is really getting making sure that each institution in each state really engages their faculty in this judgment study and in this in the different pieces of research that are being used for standard setting, which includes benchmarking data against NAEP and ACT and SAT. We're still working on the standard, doing the planning for the standard setting. So we've also considered separate studies using benchmarking PARC scores against ACCUPLACER and Compass. But again, I think that I would say that there's really strong engagement from the campus level in the potential for this of this as a placement tool, and I think that the foundation for using it is again, some states are much more prepared than others. Some states have communicated to their campuses earlier on and have been more engaged in the process from the very beginning. So I think those states are a little bit on the forefront of being prepared. But I think moving forward, it will really come down to how states participate in the actual validation of the assessment and the continued development of the assessment through item reviews, as I was talking about earlier. So I don't know if that exactly answers your question, but I would say that as far as the foundation of engagement and awareness, I'd say that we are pretty strong.
Adam, as a health member, I would, judging from what is discussed on the calls and many meetings I've been to, I would agree with that. And I can tell you, in Illinois, the question, and you brought up the CAO, the question is not whether or not we're going to use the PARC score. The question, I mean, that's an assumption that institutions are going to see the scores, we're going to have to utilize them, and assuming that the validation plays out as we expect it to, that if they have a 4 and a 5, they're going to be able to go into credit-bearing courses. Some of the questions are, what they're really getting at is some of the more nuanced issues, like what to do with somebody who scores a 3, because some of those students may be ready and some may not, and you know, there's some issues to figure out there. And I already mentioned the fourth-year math. I mean, so there are some things like that we're trying to have a statewide systemic approach to, rather than having each campus go and do their own thing. Certainly in the community college arena, that's the case at least. But there's engagement across all the campuses in Illinois that I've seen, and I've seen that same thing bear out in the meetings that I've been involved with the PARC folks as well.
This is Lori Dwyer in Virginia. Can I ask a follow-up question, Adam?
Yes, please.
So following up on that, that's a question mark that was in my head, is a kind of a transfer component. Now, in Virginia, all of our dual enrollment is run out of community colleges, and so one of the considerations that's always in the back of our mind is transferability and the 4 years perception of admission policies and assessments and things of that nature. So you said that the 4 years have been engaged. Is there a sense of agreement and acceptability of the college readiness standards that PARC is providing, or is there a hesitation, or maybe that will come through the faculty assessment piece, or what's the general tenor? We tend to get some resistance early on from 4-year institutions that then, you know, come along. But I didn't know if that's being experienced with the PARC process at all or not.
I could speak to that. I mean, in many of our PARC states, when they started this work 3 years ago, they really made sure to include, you know, in these campus teams or even state teams, 4 years as well as 2 years, because of what you're talking about. In order for students to successfully transfer, we can't not have the buy-in of the 4-year institution. So I would say, among our PARC states, each PARC state has its own group of leaders. So we have our PARC state higher education leadership team, and then in each PARC state we have a group of between, you know, 4 to 6 leaders as well, and all of those teams usually include someone from a 4-year, from a president from a 4-year institution or an administrator, 2-year institution representatives, as well as higher ed policy folks from the state. So we've really done a lot of work from the very beginning on, like, looking ahead to that particular policy piece. So I would say that it's really that there's cross-sector engagement in all of our PARC states.
I've just jumped in too, Lynn, and this is Brenda. I'm on the higher education leadership team from Colorado, and our 4 years are definitely been engaged, as Lynn said, but I do think that they're waiting on to see the longitudinal validity study, and they've expressed that once they see that, then they can really trust this test, and they will use it more, they will embrace it more fully. So, and that won't happen, or the results of it won't be out really till 2017 or 2018.
Right.
So just keeping that timeline in mind, and our 4 years really have stressed the importance of that longitudinal validity test.
Yeah, this is Brian. I would agree. And one of the conversations we're always really careful with the 4-year folks is that, you know, PARC is not meant to be an admissions test. And that's kind of one of the first knee-jerk reactions you'll hear from individuals who have not been engaged up front with the conversation. I mean, there's a huge communication piece to it, of course, and, you know, being careful about that. And I mean, I, as a state higher ed person, I have to acknowledge that, you know, the longitudinal validity piece is huge, and it's huge for community colleges. But community colleges, I think, are overall more open to it because they're already having to deal with so many students that are taking placement anyway, and they're looking for alternatives to Compass. So, you know, but it's a, by and large, you know, everybody is kind of waiting to see how those that longitudinal studies play out. But the community college sector here is willing to move forward on it and then do some of their own analysis, which we're also encouraging all the institutions to do with the data ahead of any statewide or national studies that come out on it. So, you, Adam, we want to move on. Lynn, thank you very much for taking the time to do this.
Of course. I'm happy to be on the call.
Great. Well, with that, I'm going to go ahead and mute the attendees' lines again, and then we will turn it over to Lori. And, Lori, if you can take control of the presentation now, that would be great.
Okay, it says loading. Here we go. All right. Can folks see House Bill 1184? Adam, jump in if you cannot, but I know everybody
yes,
else
can.
This is, again, Lori Dwyer in the Virginia Community College System, and we've had a lot of activity in concurrent enrollment, or what we call dual enrollment in Virginia, and so Adam asked me to share with you specifically some activity around House Bill 1184 that came out in 2012 and the impacts and process for which our colleges have implemented it, and it directly speaks to concurrent enrollment. So what I'd like to do is just spend a few minutes going through and talking to you about what happened in Virginia, how we moved through the process, some advantages that the legislation has provided to us, and some challenges that counter it. And then, again, I'm open for questions. I don't know if Adam wants to take them after each or move on and take them at the end, but I'm certainly available during this call or any time after. I know I've heard from a few other states that are on the brink of some sort of legislation that may have some semblance to this, so if there's anything that I can do or help you or learning from our experience, then certainly reach out to me at any time. I'm happy to help. The gist, if you will, of House Bill 1184 was that it required each of our community colleges, and we have 23 of them in Virginia, to work with their local school divisions to develop agreements that would allow every high school, would allow any high school student the opportunity to complete an associate's degree or a one-year general education certificate concurrent with high school graduation. So, in other words, if they're eligible and meet can do the pathway that I'll show you in a minute, they have the opportunity in every single school division to earn either an associate's degree concurrent with high school graduation or a one-year general education certificate, which we've established here in Virginia. And those typically range anywhere from, I think, about 31 to 34 credits. So it's sort of your first year gen ed courses. This bill came out in 2012, and it indicated a timeline that we had to have these pathways developed by April 1 of 2013. So we'll talk a little bit more about the process that we underwent to implement this. But before I move forward into that, I just want to give you a little bit of a landscape of what this legislation was, what existed in already, because we had a pretty robust dual enrollment program in Virginia, and it's almost exclusively offered by the community colleges in Virginia. We have a few four-year institutions that kind of have really niche markets, but with governor schools or things of that nature, but for by and large, dual enrollment is almost exclusively offered by the community colleges. And so, as I indicated earlier with my question, we always have transfer in the back of our mind because 4 years typically don't offer dual enrollment. And so we're transfer's a very big deal here in our dual enrollment world. Dual enrollment between public schools and our colleges is governed by the Virginia Plan for Dual Enrollment, which is an agreement that's signed by the state superintendent, our chancellor, and the Secretary of Education. And in fact, the last time that plan was signed was 2008, and we have a work group convening this fall to re-up that. But it outlines a general framework for which dual enrollment can be offered. It stipulates that our faculty have to be credentialed and that the students can take it at the high school, at the college, online, et cetera. One of the stipulations in there is that dual enrollment is for juniors and seniors only. Freshmen and sophomore can only take dual enrollment on a case-by-case exception, and that requires a signature by the high school principal and the college president on a case-by-case basis. And we do not offer developmental education, any remedial courses, to our dual enrollment students. And so that as a foundation within Virginia is what this legislation was coming into, and does offer some additional complexities to align with that legislation, because you're now looking at getting students through the associate's degree in their predominantly in their junior and senior year, and only to those that are already college ready heading into that time frame. So you can imagine, as we received this legislation, we were excited about the access component of it. We are excited about the opportunities to kind of enrich our relationships with our K-12 partners. But there were some concern about the feasibility, logistics, making sure we were admitting students that were genuinely college ready, and things of that nature. So how we proceeded in managing and implementing the legislation, we began a work group in July. So legislation came out in early 2012. In July, we had assembled a work group that consisted of administration from our community colleges, some folks from the front lines like dual enrollment coordinators and faculty, as well as representatives from DOE. And although the legislation really called for the community colleges to work with the school divisions, that inherently calls for school divisions to work with the community colleges, so it was a bidirectional relationship. And that sort of led the work group. That being said, it was the community colleges' responsibilities to actually offer the courses, credential the faculty, provide the placement testing, et cetera. So we really kind of took the lead with that and in that work group. And that what they did, the culmination of their work really resided in a guidance document that went out to our colleges about how they can implement. We didn't tell our colleges how their pathways had to look or how they had to get them to the associate's degree, but we helped and we wrestled with a lot of issues around scheduling, down to the details of scheduling, how are you going to placement test that many students, what kind of faculty. And one of the things that kind of comes into play here are some pieces of the legislation that eased some of the burden of it, which was we can still accept advanced placement scores for courses. Courses could be required to be taken on campus, so if we couldn't get a class full at the high school site, we could offer it on campus. And so with some of these flexibilities, this is where we were really able to pull these pathways together. The legislation was, of course, brought forward by legislators and not necessarily folks in the dual enrollment education process. And therefore, there was an April 15th deadline, which kind of was really out of cycle with our dual enrollment contracts and scheduling and policy development. So what we did was, to abide by that legislation, all of the plans, their pathways, if you will, the community colleges and the school divisions worked together and developed a plan and had that plan signed off that was how they were going to move forward And then they just adhered that to subsequent contracts that came about later in the cycle. And now that we are in the throes of this, they are submitted annually with their contracts to the system office. We receive each year from each of our colleges a submission of what their plan is for HB 1184, and that's an appendix to their annual contract. Locally, what often happened was a president and vice presidents of the colleges were meeting with the superintendents to acknowledge the legislation and kind of make a high-level agreement to work through it, and then it would go forth from there, and there was some philosophical agreement about, okay, we're going to honor this much AP, or we're going to require students to come to campus for this much, and then it would filter down into the exact course offerings and how it would be delivered. There were a number of considerations that the work group and as in these local conversations that came into play, and that the chief among which was our accreditation. Most of our colleges needed to go through some sort of substantive change policy for us, which was set with our regional accreditor, SACS, because what this said was they are going to be offering, in many cases, a majority of the degree on off-site locations, meaning the high schools. For this reason, we couldn't necessarily begin offering the associate's degrees or gen ed certificates that fall under the pathways, but it was a plan for implementation that they were developing. It should be kept in mind as well that some of our colleges were already offering graduating students with associate's degrees. We had one college in particular that was graduating dozens of students like this every year, and so this was really for them just documenting it. We had other colleges who did not offer a lot of concurrent enrollment, and this required not only substantive change but a significant expansion of their dual enrollment programs, which was a positive outcome of the legislation. Additional considerations, because we only accept college-ready students and we need to know how to place them, that means placement testing for all of our students. On the heels of this legislation, our admissions policy was also changed, which offered some challenges, self-imposed challenges, through a changed admission policy and placement test requirements. Making sure we had appropriate faculty credentialing, SIS and data tracking, how are we seeing the students, what we call HB 1184 students, so are they degree intending, because those students will require more intense advising, et cetera, or are they just a dual enrollment student that's not degree intend or credential intending. Of course, the communication and scheduling, and as always, transfer is whether the four-year institutions will acknowledge the associate's degree under our transfer agreements and things of that nature is a whole other discussion that is ongoing in Virginia. This is a sample of the implementation plan outline that, you know, it may be a little bit difficult to read the footnotes there in this print, but the work group put together, and this is what all of our colleges have to complete with their school divisions and submit to us, and it outlines their plan of which degree they're offering, and most of our colleges are for the associate's degree are offering in terms of their plan associate of general studies or associate of arts or associate of science. There are not many that are doing an applied degree, but they have to include the course, the term and schedule, the location, the delivery methods, how many credits it is, who's providing the faculty. Does it fulfill a high school requirement as well? And if so, what's that high school name or the high school course name? So we get one of these for the associate degree and one of these for the general certificate from each of our 23 colleges every year. This legislation was a little bit shocking when it first came about. We were somewhat a part of the creation of it, but there was still, like I said, this meant some tremendous change and growth in Virginia in our dual enrollment. And although that was a little bit shocking initially, it really has done a lot for us in terms of providing that dual enrollment accessibility to students in those regions where dual enrollment was not offered with any great, was not very broadly offered. It is now. And so we've seen some great growth there. We may not we're still early, so early that it's a little bit difficult to see the impact in actual students graduating with associates or gen ed certificates. We'll begin to see that, I think, in about another year or two, and what the success rates are and that, things of that nature. But what we can see already is that we have more students attaining at least some credit. So maybe the student that wouldn't have gotten any is now getting 6 credits or 20 credits, or the one that was getting 20 is now getting the certificate or the degree. We're seeing an increased recognition of the validity of dual enrollment legislatively as well as in our transfer discussions. Because there's some legislative support, it helps give the validity when we have these sometimes difficult transfer conversations. There's an enhanced affordability, which is just by virtue of our financial structure in Virginia around concurrent enrollment. But also on the heels of this legislation, not only did we update our admissions policy for dual enrollment, we also have a new financial model that accompanies and requires a certain amount of reimbursement to the students when tuition reimbursement when the courses are taught in the high school with high school faculty. So those are some of the advantages. So the challenges are what you might expect logistically, getting the scheduling in place, managing this volume of testing, which was interesting listening to the PARC conversation and how you had two birds with one stone between taking your required PARC test and then the college placement test. We have integrated some SOL components into our dual enrollment admissions policy, but not to the degree of what was we were hearing earlier about the PARC process. And then again, we've had to revise some policies, some internal VCCS policies following this legislation, and while they help facilitate a stronger dual enrollment environment, it has in some instances put some strain on hard-fought relationships between the K-12 school divisions and the local community colleges as they're working to implement these pathways under an environment that has a change, is kind of a changing policy environment, ongoing change. So advantages and disadvantages, and I would summarize it, it's the advantages and disadvantages that come with change. This is not unexpected advantages and challenges, but that's exactly what we do face. And I think we've gone through the bulk of that at this point. We're really now more in colleges are hitting their stride with their plans. They're starting to find their niche with each of the school division they serve and how they're going to do this and what area and what types of students it's going to be best for. And adapting to our revised policies. So I think we're starting to hit stride, but there was quite a bit of uprooting what we were our previous culture and frame of mind around dual enrollment into this in the new one to align with legislation. So that's my piece, but I'll stop presenting. I'm open to questions, and again, I'm open to questions not only during today's call, but if there's anything that I can do or if you need any further detail about what we did to help your state align with any potential legislation, don't hesitate to let me know.
Thanks, Lori. I think we will jump straight into Colorado and then take questions at the end. So with that, I think Michelle, if you can take over as presenter and go ahead and start with the Colorado presentation.
Yeah, my takeover as presenter button went away when Dana took hers off, and I am lost now.
Okay, well, let's see if we can hand it over to you. If not, we can go ahead and drive the slides for you.
Yeah, I'm no longer seeing that take over as presenter button as an option for me, like I was before.
It likewise has disappeared for me, so why don't, if you don't mind just getting started, and we'll try and get it up here in a second.
Oh, actually, did I get it? Am I there? Hey, there we go.
Okay, good.
Okay, I got it. All right, thanks, Adam. So I'm Michelle Camacho-Liu. I work in our Office of Post-Secondary Readiness at the Colorado Department of Education. And joining me kind of as a resource is Brenda Bausch. She is our P20 Alignment Director at the Department of Higher Education, and we work together on concurrent enrollment. I'll be taking the lead for this presentation, but Brenda will be kind of on backup as we have if we have any questions that she can help us with as well. So I really just wanted to share how Colorado is using concurrent enrollment as a lever to support students to post-secondary readiness and earning a credential. So a quick look at a Colorado landscape to put the work we're doing of concurrent enrollment in context. Our beautiful Colorado landscape, as you can see. Not so subtle reminder that this is a beautiful place to be and live and work and play, and encourage you all to come spend your time and money with us. But also relevant to our conversation because it's one of the things that exemplifies what we call the Colorado paradox. The Colorado paradox basically is that we're really great at importing our talent, and this is one of the reasons why. We actually have one of the highest percentages of residents that hold a college degree, but we're relatively low college completion rate for our native-born residents. So added to that, you've probably seen this data for your own state, but this is PARS for Colorado for our job growth and education needs, and this has also been a big driving factor in relationship to that Colorado paradox, because we have one of the highest percentage of jobs that will require education beyond high school and one of the lowest percentage of jobs that will require high school diploma or less. So we're not going to meet these goals just by importing. We know we have to do a much better job in supporting our own students here at home to be prepared for this job market. So this is our post-secondary workforce readiness definition. Our State Board of Education and Commission on Higher Education came together to create this joint definition. I just wanted to point out two things here, because this has really been one area that, you know, has driven and focused the work of both of our organizations. There's an equal focus on college and workforce, and also there's a focus not just on what our graduates know, but what they can do. So at the same time that folks were creating this definition, there was an overhaul of our dual enrollment opportunities in Colorado. And this was really part of then-Governor Ritter's P20 Council. So they were working on multiple things, one of which was that shared definition. And then we had the passage of our Concurrent Enrollment Programs Act right around that same time. So before we had these programs that were kind of disjointed, they were very limited. It was only for our 11th and 12th graders. I think we paid for only two courses, and it was largely seen only for those students that had already exhausted all their high school opportunities. So we really saw a lot of inequity, really, in the types of students that were participating. We had huge support for this act from the legislature, and actually it passed unanimously. This is our definition of concurrent enrollment. As you can see, it's pretty basic and straightforward. Again, I think one of the reasons for this was to make it more broad and accessible. Key and purposeful component that you can see here, though, is the inclusion of career tech education courses as an option for concurrent enrollment. This is the legislative intent that was laid out in statute. Again, a big focus on equity and access, particularly for students that might have low college participation rates. There's also that connection to post-secondary workforce readiness, including engagement, and a focus on earning a credential. There's a focus on the alignment between secondary and post-secondary and accountability to verify that we're actually reaching our goals. And last, there's this creation of a fifth-year program called Ascent that I'll speak more to in just a moment. This is our eligibility for concurrent enrollment. As you can see, we can start as early as the ninth grade. But there is very purposeful language in there around meeting prerequisites for courses, as well as being in alignment with a student's individual plan of study. Funding, just a quick note, it's really important that this is not a separate pot of money. Districts are using their per-pupil revenue to pay the student portion of the tuition, but that's limited to being at the community college resident rate. Quick look at the delivery models that we have. Again, just to note that this is something we hope is very flexible and accessible to our districts in the way in which they think they can provide the best for their students. And just highlight a couple things here. One is GT Pathway. These are our guaranteed transfer courses. These are courses that we can say, and there's agreements between our 2 and 4 year institutions, that if a student takes this particular concurrent enrollment community college course, it's guaranteed to transfer for academic credit to any of our public institutions. CTE, I mentioned before, is another component that we think is really important for our students. We actually had in our 2012-13 year over 7,000 students in concurrent enrollment take at least one CTE course. And just really quickly, we really think CTE is one of those great examples already happening of having students not just showing what they know, but showing what they can do. And so there's been really increased focus on this opportunity, not just for concurrent enrollment, but generally for our secondary students as a whole. Because the more data we dig into, we see that this is improving engagement, and it's also improving our academic outcomes. We're seeing this in standardized tests for those that are taking CTE courses. Then I'll just go into a little bit more detail right now about remedial courses and our Ascent fifth year program. The first remediation in concurrent enrollment. This is something that was specifically addressed and allowed through legislation, but it is limited. It is only for our 12th graders or those that have been retained past their 12th grade year for additional instruction. This is not for our Ascent students. That's a different program, but any students that were held back because potentially they haven't yet met academic graduation requirements. And we really see this as an opportunity to use the 12th grade as a bridge year. One spoke to that in terms of PARC, and during the 11th grade, largely right now, our students are taking ACT and likely will be doing PARC here soon, and districts are using those kind of assessments to hone in on those students that could really use this 12th grade year as a last push to be ready to make that transition for college. We believe that before that, really, those 9th through 11th grade years, the focus is on the high school courses to get them prepared to that level. But if we know that at the end of that time period, they're not quite there yet, this gives us that one last push. So it's a relatively small portion of our concurrent enrollment students that are taking the remedial courses, but we're seeing a lot of growth in the number of students and districts that are taking advantage of this tool. Our pass rates, you can see 76% pass rate for remedial CE courses. Definitely some room for improvement, particularly when you compare it to our overall pass rate for concurrent courses. But we still know that we're reaching those students that likely need this the most, that may not have thought they could otherwise go to or stay in college if they didn't get that remediation done beforehand. Next, we'll look at our Ascent fifth year program. So ASCENT stands for Accelerating Students Through Concurrent Enrollment. And as mentioned before, this is for students to participate in concurrent enrollment for an additional year after their 12th grade year. These are the objectives that were outlined in statute. Again, always the focus of increased access and equity, particularly for our underserved students, a focus on engagement and using this as an incentive, in a sense, to complete high school. And obviously, it's a time and money saver for our students, as they're being able to be supported by their high school's time and money to provide them the credits towards the credential. This is the eligibility requirements for Ascent. So immediately after their 12th grade year, they must already have, before entering the Ascent program, 12 post-secondary credits. They cannot be in need of remediation, and they have to be admitted to a specific degree or certificate program. So looking at those priority objectives and this eligibility, we're really working to get the highest return on investment by targeting particularly underserved students and focus on those that might be the closest towards completing that credential with just that little bit of extra time and financial support. And this program is really growing rapidly. As our districts are getting their concurrent enrollment programs more in line and up to date, they're getting more of these students to that 12 credit and remediation-free threshold to qualify for Ascent. Districts we know are also in the process of refining their targeting processes to determine the students that would benefit most from this program. Financially, it's important to note that it's a little different from concurrent enrollment. There are actually limited funds that are allocated by our legislature each year, separate from districts per pupil revenue. So this really makes that prioritizing and targeting of students even more important. So kind of went over some of the intent of the legislation about our Concurrent Enrollment Programs Act and the various components of concurrent enrollment that we think are particularly important towards helping students get college ready, get their credential, and we need to really see, does this work? And like I mentioned, there's accountability that's built into the legislation. And so each year, the Department of Ed and the Department of Higher Ed work together on an annual report to report the participation and outcomes of our concurrent enrollment students. So just going to look really quickly at the data from our most recent report that came out this year for the students that participated in the 2012-13 school year. This is the growth of our concurrent enrollment overall. Again, really rapid growth. We're seeing a little bit of a slowdown in growth as there's just more and more districts that had already got online before now, but we still continue to see the steady progress. This is just an overall look statewide of participation. Everything in purple there is at least one high school student is participating in concurrent enrollment. There's actually a goal laid out in the original legislation to have every district enter into one agreement with an institution of higher education to be able to provide their students with concurrent enrollment. So we're getting pretty close. So we'll look at our participation by race and ethnicity. Again, this very big focus on equity and access. If you had seen this graph of what it looked like in 2009 for concurrent enrollment student participation, it looks very different. Now what you see here is very comparable to our overall Colorado high school student demographic. In terms of outcomes, our students are having pretty great success. Over 90% are passing some or all of their concurrent enrollment courses and attempting about 8 credits during the year. This is, an outcome that we're particularly excited about is seeing the actual credentials earned by our concurrent enrollment and Ascent students. So these are folks that are graduating high school not only with their high school diploma but with some kind of credential, a post-secondary credential, and this is growing enormously fast, the 60% increase we saw this year, the 12-13 year over the previous year. We're seeing this growth, again, as districts are getting more on top and aligned with their concurrent enrollment programs to their students' individual goals. And like I mentioned, with one of the highest percentage of jobs that will require education beyond high school, really a large portion of these are jobs that will require a certificate or associate's degree, which is what you're seeing here. So particularly with Ascent, these students are already entering with 12 credits, and they have an entire year focused on concurrent enrollment. So there's a really good chance that a lot of these students can finish their Ascent year with some sort of credential. We've also done some comparative analysis between students that participate in dual enrollment and those that don't. And in these key areas that you can see here, enrollment after high school graduation, retention, cumulative hours, and first-year college GPA, these are all indicators that we know increase the likelihood of students to complete college. And our students that are participating in dual enrollment are doing better in all these areas than their peers. Brenda took things even a step further and did some comparisons holding gender, income, race, ethnicity, and ACT scores constant, and we still see these improved rates of enrollment and need for remediation among our dual enrollment students. So with that, really, we're definitely in this process of continuous improvement and finding ways to prioritize and streamline this process for students and for districts, and we're learning more and more of what's working and what's not working. I did have a slide in here that had our contact information, so I can send that to Adam again, and it also has a link to our annual report, if folks wanted to take a look at that. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Adam.
Well, great, and somehow missed getting that slide loaded in, I will put up on the screen everybody's contact information. Thank you to all three of you for presenting today, and I'm going to go ahead and unmute the lines and turn it over to the audience for questions.
This is Brian. Michelle and Brenda, Do you have, we were talking about this last piece on program outcomes. Do you, is that a study that has been written about Colorado? Is that available somewhere to look at?
Hi, this
Okay,
sorry. It's available on our, it was something we did here internally at the Department of Higher Education. So it's available on the Higher Education website, and we can have Adam send out that the link to the PDF.
That would be great. We'd love to replicate your method, potentially.
Great.
Hi, this is Robin Golden. I have a question about funding. So I understand in the Colorado program that there is some limited funds for the what do you call it, the fifth year, and that the districts use their per pupil revenue for just the regular dual enrollment. What, how has the, how have your districts responded to that? We in Connecticut are about to, you know, try to develop our own dual enrollment policies, and we're looking at funding in particular. And I think that if we told the districts right now that they were going to pay for this out of their per pupil revenue, they would cry.
Sure. You know, different districts are approaching this differently, and I think it's important to, first of all, say that, you know, we're working really hard to put this in context and not say, okay, this is just one other thing that, you know, you can do, so here you go, but really connecting it with other initiatives towards our post-secondary readiness. You know, for example, we've completely overhauled our graduation guidelines / requirements, and concurrent enrollment is a piece of that. So that's kind of one of the incentives behind feeling like this is a good use of funds. The other piece is between the agreements between the institutions and the districts. There's actually, particularly within our urban districts, the opportunity for, if these are being held at the high school campus with a high school instructor that has been credentialed to be, to teach as an adjunct, there's really minimal cost for the district. There's an agreement that really they only are paying a small, or the institutions are getting a small portion of the student tuition, and otherwise the districts aren't really paying anything in those instances. Where we're seeing a lot more areas for improvement are with our rural districts. They just don't have the numbers, for one, behind, and a lot of, there's actually a few that don't have a community college as a partner in their region, and so they're working more with our four-year institutions. And so because they only have to pay up to the community college rate, anything above that could be the student, student responsibility. But they don't have the numbers. It's a little bit more difficult for them to find, qualified faculty. So we're really trying to hone in on working with those folks on what their options are. And some of that is through distance learning, potentially, or programs to incentivize or support getting their faculty trained.
Great. Thank you so much. Can I ask Dana this, a similar question about funding? So I think you said something about how it was funded, but I didn't actually catch it. So this is required of any high school student, I assume, that's interested. How does this get paid for?
Is that question to Lori in Virginia?
Oh, I'm sorry. Lori in Virginia. Sorry.
Okay. No problem. I just wanted to make sure. There was no funding associated with this legislation whatsoever, and so it really fell to the financial models that existed between our local colleges and divisions, which is why where we saw a tremendous amount of inconsistency. And so that is one of the reasons why we established a financial model. And the financial model really only addresses how students are charged and reimbursed at the when courses are taught in the high school by high school faculty. When they're coming to our college campuses for these courses, they're charged full tuition and fees with no reimbursement. And so there was no state appropriation to support the funding. Colleges largely absorb the cost of staff and placement testing. And the funding model in general would be that the schools get ADM and we get FTE for each dual enrollment student, but there was no, and bear in mind that post-secondaries have not been fully funded on FTE for quite a few years now, but there's no additional funding.
So that seems to me to be a setup for a non-equitable system, right? If you, I mean, because the student has to pay for the college courses?
Well, correct. The hope is that under our new financial model, minimally 60%, if the course is taught in the high school by the high school instructor, credentialed instructor, which is a good portion of the courses, minimally they have to be reimbursed 60% of the tuition, and in many cases it goes up to 100%. And what determines that percentage is a collaboration agreement between the college and the school division to support career and college readiness initiatives. So, for example, we have a career coaching model in Virginia, and if they agree to partner in and hire another career coach to support these students, then they can get another 10% reimbursement. And so there's kind of this model that supports it. And what in many instances, what you'll see is, I would say on average it's an 80% reimbursement rate sometimes, but in some school divisions we're seeing these, a lot of graduates out of the program, they're up to 100% reimbursement, so that brings in the equity piece.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, if they're coming to college, or coming to campus to take the courses, financially speaking, it's...
Right, and the reimbursement that's being is the district is reimbursed, the school district reimburses the student?
The college reimburses whoever pays. So
okay.
We have a state policy that every student has to pay full tuition and fees, no exceptions. And
uh-huh.
So in many cases, although this varies a little bit, the division will pay the college for all the students, and then the college
uh-huh.
will reimburse the division. We reimburse whoever pays.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Lori, this is Sharmila. I was wondering, so the Colorado folks talked a little bit about their transfer agreement with 4 years. So I was wondering, in Virginia, how you guys are doing that. Is there a transfer agreement, a different transfer agreement for these concurrent enrollment degrees? I know you don't have any students that have gone all the way through yet. But the other thing I was wondering is that it seems like with the amount of time that they have, probably most students won't be achieving an associate's degree. They might achieve a certificate. More likely they'll have a certain number of credits. So is that something that would be included in a state articulation agreement, or is that a one-by-one as far as the individual institutions are concerned?
We have in Virginia statewide guaranteed admission agreements that kind of facilitate transfer into our primary and, you know, our state institutions and some of our private nonprofit institutions as well. And we had to revisit every one of those when this legislation came through and indicate whether they would or would not accept the degree, because what those transfer agreements essentially say is if the student has completed an associate's degree with X GPA, they will be admitted as a junior and all their lower level gen ed is waived. So the question then became is, our argument as the community colleges and providers of this education is that they have to place into the courses, they're held to the college level rigor, breadth, depth of the curriculum, and therefore they've earned the same associate's degree and it should transfer the same. A bulk of our four-year institutions agreed with that and wrote into the transfer agreement that any courses earned through dual enrollment or any credentials earned through the completion of dual enrollment courses would not prevent them from taking advantage of the guaranteed admission agreement. There are a handful of institutions that are still struggling with that and have said, we will not accept these students. You can apply and be admitted, and we may transfer the credit, but you're not going to get the guaranteed admission and waiver of lower level gen ed. We're going to look at course by course articulation. And then one thing that I think was a big conversation, and some institutions, 4-year institutions, and our office have come up with, I think, a good solution in some scenarios where they say, we'll accept you under the guaranteed admission agreement for transfer, and we'll apply all your academic credit and waive your lower level gen ed. But you still have to from a psychosocial level, you're still 18, and you're still going to be held to the other freshman requirements, like living in the dorm, taking your freshman seminar class, things of that nature. And so there's a middle ground that's been reached in some agreement that sort of recognizes the academic accomplishments, but also acknowledges the psychosocial aspects of having an 18-year-old with her first experience truly at a university setting.
Thank you.
But I will say this is still a point of contention that we're working on with some institutions, and I suspect it will be one that we're working on for some time.
Other questions? Well, I have one. In both Colorado and Virginia, you talked about sort of in different contexts when students sort of get identified as degree seeking for earning the general studies certificate or an associate's degree. And Laura, you mentioned it sort of in the context of the data system. And I guess I'm wondering, at what point is a student merely a student who's taken 3, 6, 9, 12 credit hours of dual enrollment versus a student who's identified as going towards an associate degree? And likewise, in Colorado, at what point do students become ASCEND students for the fifth year program versus a student who's just taking one or two or three concurrent enrollment courses?
In Virginia, when they fill out the online application, they indicate whether they're program placed or not. And if they're program placed, our SIS will pick up if they're program placed and do not yet have a high school diploma, then we flag them and they're coded a certain way so that we know they're program seeking and yet still not financial aid eligible. Because they are the age they are when they're filling out this application and don't always know what they're doing, we have folks on the ground that are working with the students, and if they're credential intending and they haven't indicated that appropriately on the application, we'll go in and indicate it in SIS for them and code them that way. And so you could be credential intending when you apply your sophomore year for admission your junior year. And then we really try to code that appropriately because we feel that those students are going to need more counseling in terms of course scheduling, placement testing, transferability, understanding what transfer agreements will apply to them and won't. But that's been a bit of a culture shift that our colleges are still working through. They, for years and years and years, never tracked who was program placed and who wasn't because it didn't really matter. If you happened to get your associate's degree, then that was rare, but kudos to you, and that was the end of it. And now we actually not only track that for purpose of advising, but our governor has implemented, or our previous governor implemented, what he called governor's medallions that are distributed for graduation at both the college and high school graduation for these students to wear with their regalia. So we are responsible to report to the governor's office how many program intended students actually earned the medallion. And to answer a previous question too, we actually awarded about 600 medallions this last year, and that's between the certificate and the associate's degree. So the thing is that we don't know how many of those we would have anyway. I don't think a lot of that is due to HB 1184 because we're just now starting to implement it. That's probably only slightly above what we would have done prior to legislation.
So this is Michelle in Colorado. So the only time that our students are required to officially declare a degree or certificate program is if they're participating in a ASCEND, and so that would be for the end of their 12th grade year as part of that application process and verification they would do with their high school. Before that, really what we're asking our districts to do is to align any courses that students are taking with what we call our individual career and academic plans. So this is essentially our state version of individual learning plans. We ask that all these courses are on that track, and so oftentimes there's a degree or a profession that's specified as the end goal, and so all concurrent enrollment courses should be getting folks to that goal. Whether it's specific degree seeking as it's laid out with the college doesn't necessarily have to be until that ascent year.
Thanks. Well, I realize now by asking a question, I've jumped into my own time when I'm supposed to talk briefly about the state policy leadership workshop day that we've reserved prior to the NACIP conference on October the 26th. That's the Sunday before the NACIP conference in Chicago in October. Just a few updates, and those of you who need to get going, I know we're approaching the very time, should feel free to jump off, and those who have a few more minutes and want to stick on and provide some input are most welcome to. We have a small steering committee. Three people had volunteered to help put together an agenda, so we will be over the rest of the summer working on that agenda and appreciate all of your input into the types of activities you'd like to do during that day and what your goals are, the topics you'd like to hear. We've also been in a couple conversations recently with some other organizations that have interests similar to ours in this area to support state policy making in college transition and concurrent and dual enrollment. And so we're hoping to involve a broader range of organizations rather than being, you know, it will be an ASAP event, but we're hoping to have some partner organizations there helping out with some facilitation and bringing some resources to the table as we get folks together. So with that, I want to again thank all our presenters today, and if you do have any questions, the contact information for them is all up on the screen, and I will send it around afterwards. I will send around a link as requested to the Colorado Annual Report. I think it's a great model for those states that are considering doing an annual report on dual or concurrent enrollment, because it both includes demographic information and participation information, as well as some of the outcome-based data as well. And please do go ahead and provide some input into the agenda for the convening in Chicago. With that, thanks again for joining us today.